is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 6th, 2004. Prison guards on trial for staging gladiator fights between inmates before killing them. Electroshock stun belts that leave a man groveling or unconscious. Pregnant women shackled to beds. Caustic pepper spray methodically daubed or sprayed on the face and eyes of nonviolent protesters. Scores of supermax high-security prisons with conditions so inhumane the legendary Alcatraz jail near San Francisco seems mild. These are not a fictional Hollywood mix of ancient Rome and third millennium Singapore. This treatment was at the core of the first United Nations report on torture in the United States, from New England and New York to Los Angeles and Seattle, a report that was issued in May 2000. It was called by the Sunday Herald in Scotland, Jailhouse Horror in the Land of the Free. Of the world's 8 million inmates, 2 million are in the United States' overflowing jails, reported the Sunday Herald. Of those, 60% are minorities, while only one quarter of the U.S. population is African American or Latino. In fact, according to the United States government official statistics, one out of every three African American males, one out of six Hispanic males, and one out of 17 Caucasian males can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. What we are talking about are stun guns and stun belts with product names such as Intimidator, White Lightning, Freedom, and Consumer Spirit, manufactured in the United States. Amnesty International reports that the prison inmate population has increased almost sevenfold from 1980, 24 years ago, from 300,000 to over 2 million. Chain gangs have been introduced. Work crews are shackled together electronically or fashioned with metal chains to subdue them. No Western country other than the United States uses chain gangs or stun belts. And most egregiously are the supermax prisons. Over 200,000 inmates in 60 supermax prisons across the United States or in control units within the prisons themselves, the other regular prisons, buried alive. Torture in America, our first Taking Aim program for the year 2004.
Maya, this program, Buried Alive, is dedicated to Bonnie Kerness, the director of the American Friends Service Committee. Bonnie, who has been for...
their criminal justice program.
Yes, Maya, but for nearly or something like 30 years, Bonnie Kerness has been the key figure in amplifying our knowledge, in coordinating the campaigns, and in maintaining a consistent and constant contact with the victims of this torment and this torture across the United States. Bonnie, who most recently communicated with us in the new year and sent us her stunning reports on the horrors that we're going to recount today, is in the struggle, as she has been for 30 years, speaking, organizing, mobilizing, informing, and documenting. This is dedicated to you, Bonnie, as it is to Tafawa Balogun. Tafawa, who is in his 20th year in prison in a 30-year sentence, who is our friend and comrade, and who we've been attempting to sustain for nearly 12 years now. Of his 20 years in prison, Tafawa has spent over 10 years in total isolation. We're talking about 23 and a half hours a day lockdown, continuous abuse, torment by guards, isolation, numbing, deadening, tormenting isolation.
We should mention that Tafawa has been in prison since a youth at the age of 15 years old in many prisons throughout the state of New Jersey and currently incarcerated in East Jersey State Prison in Rahway.
And since we're taking a moment about Tafawa, let me just make this particular point. A 15-year-old boy with his 15-year-old cousin in a fight with a 13-year-old over a loaf of Wonder Bread. When the cousin picked up a stone in the course of a fight and hit the boy over the head, the boy dying, Tafawa contacting the police, informing them of the event, not involved in the actual murder, plea bargained by a public defender for 30 years and for murder one. Tried not as a child, but as an adult. Any white middle-class kid would have been out of there with parole. Not just parole, but without sentence. Immediately upon incarcerated at the age of 15, subjected to isolation, which lasted over a decade.
Buried alive. Torture in America. Let us look at first at this seminal United Nations study. Not the first study about torture, but one that targeted the United States, pinpointed the United States for the first time in UN history. It said, quote, since the United States ratified the Convention Against Torture in October 1994, its increasingly punitive approach towards offenders has continued to lead to practices which facilitate torture or other forms of ill treatment prohibited under international law. From the use of long-term isolation in super maximum security units, through the routine employment of chemical sprays to subdue suspects and prisoners, and the incarceration of asylum seekers in cruel and degrading conditions, to the use of electroshock weapons in local jails and courts, the USA is standardizing practices which undermine the aim of the convention to eradicate state torture and ill treatment from the planet, reported Amnesty International about the UN Committee Against Torture's report. Let's look at some of the examples in the UN report. Ronnie Hawkins, subjected to an 8-second 50,000-volt electroshock from a remote control stun belt in open court on the order of a judge.
To punish his verbal statements, the judges routinely authorize the use of electric shock through stun belts on prisoners when the prisoner tries to ask a question to assert their rights or to challenge a ruling.
Inmates at two supermax prisons in Virginia subjected to arbitrary electroshocks from stun belts. Perry Connor, beaten in the genital area repeatedly, electroshocked until he lost control of his bowels and not allowed to shower for 6 days. Widespread punitive solitary confinement and excessive use of shackling, handcuffing, and four-point restraint against children in a South Dakota juvenile facility. James Earl Livingston, a mentally ill man, died after being pepper sprayed and left in a restraint chair, one of several deaths associated with this device. Liquid pepper spray dabbed directly into the eyes of nonviolent anti-logging protesters, a technique allegedly is the word from the United Nations, against the WTO protesters in 1999. This is just the tip of the story, tip of the iceberg of what you're going to hear today. The torture, the grueling stories of the brutalization of individuals here in the United States, and primarily political prisoners, mentally ill prisoners, people without access, out of sight, but not out of mind.
Well, I have to emphasize here that unlike the reports of Bonnie Kerness, notwithstanding the importance of Amnesty International's documentation, the isolated instances that are cited by Amnesty International, though important, do not illuminate the fact that this is not a random instance in a given institution, but the standard treatment of prisoners in what are called ADSEG or administrative segregation, talk about a euphemism, in the management control units, in the special housing units, and of course in the supermax prisons, where this form of sustained torment is routinized and constant for the very mass of the prison population so treated. It is the most barbaric, almost medieval set of standardized treatments that are accorded people in isolation, not for days, not for weeks, not for months, but for years and for decades, where 23 and a half hours a day people are without contact with other human beings and allowed into a cage attached to the cage, where they are able to do some jumping jacks at best, constantly under monitoring, shackled, subjected to belts where, from remote control, 50,000 volts, the standard charge, can be released at the whim of a sadistic guard, a constant, because these guards, as in Bayside Prison, where Tafawa has recorded the fact that the Cowtown guards actually run up a racist flag, where a majority of guards in prison after prison are in racist organizations, select their jobs and torment their victims on the basis of their race and on the basis of their being targeted as victims and specific populations designed for suppression and for a disappearance in American prisons.
The prison inside the prison. Control Units, Supermax Prisons, and Devices of Torture is a briefing paper by Rachel Kamel and Bonnie Kernis that was released by the American Friends Service Committee this last year, 2003. And in it, they speak of the Marianization of imprisonment, referring to the Marion Federal Penitentiary in Illinois, which began the first control unit in 1972. Before that and later, Prison Watch, the program of the criminal justice program of the AFSC that Bonnie Kernis had been one of the directors of, they had received letters in the 1980s about management control units in New Jersey. And then they began their lengthy investigation. Similar units to the Marion facility were established in 1972, also in New Jersey and in Massachusetts. By 1997, 45 states in the District of Columbia, as well as the federal system, were operating the specialized control units. But during the 1990s, a new generation of super maximum, or supermax prisons as they're called, spread throughout the United States. And these institutions are designed for permanent isolation of their inhabitants. According to Human Rights Watch, there are more than 20,000 prisoners, 2% of the of what they had studied, the U.S. prison population held in the long-term solitary confinement, and 56,000 in control units, with over 200,000 reported by the Sunday Herald in isolation itself, temporarily or permanently. The prisoners are confined in tiny cells the size of a parking space. Now, conceptualize this, a parking space, as Ralph said, for 23 to 24 hours a day. It's an eerie silence, and in some cases, there's constant unpleasant noise, lights on for 24 hours a day, and other forms of sensory assault. The cages, the size of the small bathroom, the parking space, with tiers of cages above and below and to either side. Many of the cells have no windows. No windows. They're soundproof. And there is little interaction with anyone other than the staff. And in many of these supermax prisons, there is no interaction with the staff either. Everything is done remotely. Therapeutic and educational programming is non-existent. And again, as Ralph said, exercise is solitary. Envision the old-style zoo where you had animals in a cage, and then the cage opened up to a little outside pen. Visits, telephone calls, and mail from family and friends are severely restricted. In many cases, it's considered a privilege so that you can get a call or a letter once a month. And reading material is heavily censored in some of the Supermax prisons. It is limited solely to your legal papers and religious material. When a prisoner leaves a cell, a strip search is conducted, even though the prisoner has not been in contact with anyone.
But Maya, the nominal entitlement to legal papers and to so-called religious materials is largely absent by its denial and abuse. Tafawa, who we have represented in so many years, whenever he would get legal papers pertaining to the court, the guards would break into his cell, they would shred the papers, they would disappear the papers, they would pour water over the papers, a routinized denial of the right to essential elements for conducting a legal process by a prisoner. In fact, anything that the prisoner has, anything that the prisoner does, it is monitored by sadistic guards who seize upon the opportunity to break in and to destroy on a random basis. Listen to this rather dry but telling abstract, The Public Health Consequences of Super Maximum Security Prisons by Robert L. Cohen, from the Department of Social Medicine and Clinical Epidemiology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, October 23, 2001. The United States has led prison design for 200 years. The early prisons in the United States were characterized by profound structural isolation. Prisoners were made to live, work, and sleep in total isolation. During the 1970s and 1980s, more collegial forms of prisons were developed. But now these institutions have been reformed on the following principle. Maximize punishment through profound isolation and extreme restriction of movement. Maximize punishment through constant psychological abuse. Maximize punishment by maintaining and encouraging the reality of extreme physical violence. Maximize security by extreme limitation of prisoner access to any outside contact. Maximize security by extreme limitation of prisoner access to programs, including medical, mental health care, routinely locking prisoners in their cells for 24 hours each day. Minimize prisoner contact, decrease number of guards through the constant use of high-tech surveillance techniques. And this dry report goes on. Now states are required to establish supermax prisons to qualify for federal funds. Access and quality of Medicare in supermax prisons has virtually disappeared. Mental health consequences to prisoners assigned to supermax prisons has been in a state of total deterioration. International expansion of supermax prisons is a consequence of the United States exporting its model. The supermax prison is an instrument of torture in violation of international treaties against torture. The abstract of the report of Public Health Consequences by Dr. Cohen. And here is Charles Dickens. Dickens, who visited the United States in the 1830s. In the 1800s and early 1900s, prisons warehoused prisoners in dirty, stark, solitary confinement cells. A large number of them never left, and those who did suffered from severe mental breakdown. A delegation from Europe came to the United States with the well-known author Charles Dickens. Upon completion of the tour, he wrote an extremely negative report. Quote, I believe that few men are capable of estimating the immense amount of torture and agony which the dreadful punishment of the United States prisons imposes and prolongs for years. There's a depth of terrible endurance in which none but the sufferers can fathom it. I hold the slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body, and because its ghastly signs and tokens are not so palpable to the eye and sense of touch as the scars upon the flesh which exist in plenitude. But the wounds that I describe are not upon the surface, and I denounce it as the secret punishment which a slumbering humanity is not roused up to stay. Charles Dickens. The prisons that Charles Dickens describes have been refined under the technology of the late 20th and 21st century into a constant of torment.
As Stuart Grassian, a psychiatrist, a member of the Harvard Medical School faculty, has stated, and Stuart Grassian did extensive studies over many years and has become the foremost expert on the psychological effects of these isolation units. Quote, the restriction of environmental stimulation and social isolation associated with confinement in solitary are strikingly toxic to mental functioning, producing a stuporous condition associated with perpetual and cognitive impairment and affective disturbances. In more severe cases, the prisoners so confined have developed florid delirium, a confusional psychosis with intense agitation, fearfulness, and disorganization. But even those prisoners who are psychologically resilient inevitably suffer severe psychological pain as a result of such confinement, especially when confinement is prolonged, and especially when the individual experiences confinement as the product of an arbitrary exercise of power and intimidation. Moreover, the harm caused by such confinement may result in prolonged or permanent psychiatric disability, including impairments which may seriously reduce the prisoner's capacity to reintegrate into the broader community upon release from prison. But what does it mean? The voices of the prisoners describe in extensive detail. As one man, who later committed suicide, had written in a letter to his family, he said, there is no hope here, no love. One time, he wrote, he was asked, I know we're only allowed 2 phone calls a month, but do you think the guards will let me call my wife real quick just to tell her I love her? And another prisoner said, I don't think you understand where you're at. This is Supermax. We're considered the worst of the worst. The guards don't care if you talk to your family or not. This man committed suicide soon afterwards.
Maya, the Albany Times Union in March 26, 2000, acknowledged the work of Dr. Stuart Grassian, who, as the article states, never set out to become the country's leading expert on the psychological torment of long-term solitary confinement on prisoners. The Harvard Medical School professor stated, I was shocked to find out that the prison psychiatrists who were supposed to be doing this job were in fact doing the opposite. They were presiding over the process. 23-hour lockdowns in special housing units, mental illness and depression, paranoia, manic activity, delusions and psychosis and suicide. These are the constants, Grassian describes. Here's what Grassian stated. New York State's early 19th century experiments with solitary confinement at Auburn Prison were undertaken to considerable shock and dismay. By the 1930s, the Auburn experiment was dropped because of the high rate of catastrophic psychiatric devastation and death, unquote. But in the past 20 years, the article continues, the devastating and harmful effects of solitary confinement on prisons have been a defining element of the prison system in the United States. State prison systems around the United States have been built at a furious pace, supermax prisons dedicated to isolating inmates in 23 and 24-hour disciplinary lockdown, a horrendous development, Grassian stated, systematically denying to these people the possibility of mental survival and physical survival as well.
Torture in U.S. prisons, evidence of U.S. human rights violation, is another report that Bonnie Kernes, the coordinator of Prison Watch, had written with Masai Ehiosi, a program assistant, in the fall of 2001. It's available on the internet at afsc.org, and I suggest you read it. It has many chapters on excessive use of force, restraints, stun technology, yard conditions, random searches, women in prison, all the aspects of prisoners' life, with many, many, many reports from the prisoners themselves, too many for us to go into during Taking Aim. But let's look at a report from Wallens Ridge State Prison in Big Stone, Virginia. A prison so large and with a small prison population of Virginia that people are brought there from other states, in Rhode Island, New Mexico, throughout the United States. On July 26th of 2000, Bernard F. wrote, quote, "On two occasions, prison guards pointed a shotgun at my face, threatened to shoot me in the head and blow my brains out. Since my arrival at the Virginia prison system, I have been subjected to administrative segregation for no reason, and my life has been continuously put in danger. I am in no way trying to find a shoulder to cry on, but only to tell someone what really takes place behind these walls. If you were to ask questions about a certain prisoner from Connecticut, they would run for cover. But on July 4th, 2000, that prisoner was murdered at this facility just because he was asking for his medication. I have heard that these officers who murdered the Connecticut prisoner are suspended with pay. But that is simply it, just suspended with pay. And when Governor Jim Gilmore was asked about the situation in this institution, he made a statement that he supported what prison officials are doing at Virginia Wallens Ridge and Red Onion prisoners." Again, buried alive. The report from Oregon State Prison in Salem, Oregon, in 2001. "If you refuse or argue, they get a team to run into your cell and get you out at all costs, after which we're pepper sprayed. Then, if one comes to the IMU, one can stay 5, 6, 8, 11, or 20 years if one isn't careful. I have seen it all. People have literally gone insane, too much stress or depression, too much medication, or they go wild over frustration and get beat up, or they decide to commit suicide. If we see the sun, the night, the fresh air, we don't. We're practically underground. No sun, no air, no night, no day." An interdepartmental memo from the Nassau County Jail was written with respect to a pre-trial detainee. That is somebody who wasn't even convicted. December 14th, 1995. This prisoner, Bruce B., was put into administrative segregation. And the memo states that prisoner B. will be handcuffed and shackled for all off-floor movement and may be handcuffed and or shackled for on-floor time out. Will have minimal contact with any other prisoner. Will receive his recreation period on the floor and will not attend religious services or any regular law library periods. Again, the building sergeant was authorized to use pepper spray and, with the use of force, to use it if he considered it necessary. This is an official memo for someone who was not even convicted, a pre-trial detainee. John Doe wrote from Massachusetts, a man who spent 10 years under solitary confinement, in condition of solitary confinement. He wrote, "I am one of many prisoners who've been given a long sentence to isolation. In Massachusetts, it's called the Department Disciplinary Unit, DDU. Prisoners can be sentenced up to 10 years of 23 hours of isolation. Just under the say-so of the prison administration. The lights in the cell are turned off at 11, and there's no getting away for any of this. In Northern State Prison, a prisoner wrote in 1999, "The extreme isolation of the control unit and the lack of human contact has caused me severe problems. I requested to see a psychologist, but haven't seen one yet. And I already have been diagnosed with high blood pressure. I experience headaches, stress, sensitivity to loud noises, ringing of the ears, loss of ability to concentrate, think, loss of memory, anxiety, agitation, paranoia, fear, and thoughts of violence from the prisoners and the other staff." A prisoner from the High Desert State Prison in Susanville, California, stated, "The running water and toilet was turned off in my cell for 5 days. This made matters even worse because I and my cellmate had been pepper sprayed and we still had the chemicals on our bodies and were unable to wash it off in the cell. There was discomfort and pain, and when we complained, the cell water was shut off. We had no way, no shower, no soap, not even a blanket or a toothbrush and tooth powder, and all the officers make jokes and laugh. Ralph?
Bonnie Kerness was the national coordinator of the campaign to abolish control unit prisons. In 1963, the Federal Bureau of Prisons shut down Alcatraz as the highest security prison, and prisoners were moved to Marion Prison in Illinois, which was placed in lockdown. Before this, lockdown was used to control and suppress disruptions within prison by severely restricting prisoners' rights. But Marion was the prison that made lockdown a permanent and generalized condition, with sensory deprivation and administrative classification to create a streamlined machine for suppressing people. And indeed, we found, as Bonnie points out, that what we have now is a two-tier system of punishment in the United States. There's the nominal judicial sentence that a prisoner receives. And then once inside the prison institution, at the total discretion of prison functionaries and at the whim of charges that are filed by by guards, prisoners are not just subjected to their original sentence, but are stripped of all contact with other human beings, are placed arbitrarily in total isolation, and are maintained there without any judicial recourse, without any administrative review, for weeks and months and years and decades, without the capacity to change that condition despite legal efforts to alter that condition. We spent years in the case of Tafawa, who had been condemned to isolation until the year 2009, and virtually acting as lawyers without license, we contrived and we managed to get into the courts the arbitrary way. We got him out after 10 years of isolation, only to have him routinely sent into the hole and subjected to these conditions again, outside the purview of the nominal revisiting of these issues by the courts. As the campaign described, years of isolation from prison and outside communities, housed in solitary cells for 22.5 hours a day minimum, denied access to education, religious work programs or reading materials, physical torture, forced cell extractions, four-point restraints, hog-tying, caging, beating after restraint, backroom beatings, set-up fights, mental torture, sensory deprivation, forced idlement, verbal abuse, mail tampering, disclosing information, confessions forced under torture, and threats against family and visitors, a litany of the torment that is now institutionalized and endemic across prisons in the United States.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Buried Alive, Torture in America. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. In 1995, the U.S. Department of Justice initiated an investigation of the Maryland Correctional Adjustment Center, the MCAC, because of reports of sexual harassment of female employees and allegations of torture of the inmates. Now, this was the United States Department of Justice, and it confirmed the use of torture in the prisons. Did it have any effect? No. The state of Maryland concluded that, wrote to the Department of Justice and said, your May 1st letter is supported by neither law or fact. But let's look at some of the findings. And these are findings of the U.S. Department of Justice. And the findings, as you know, as you can realize, are only a small part of what actually goes on. In particular, the investigation confirmed the use of a, quote, pink room And this is what was reported in a letter from Devil Patrick, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, to Paris Glendening, the governor of Maryland, in his notice of finding. Quote, an unheated strip cell inappropriately located in the medical unit where an inmate was held in isolation for punishment. The cell was made of concrete and contained no furniture or mattresses. Inmates remained in the pink room sometimes as long as 4 days, wearing only underwear and a three-piece restraint, leg irons, handcuffs, and a waist chain connected to the handcuffs and holding the hands very close to the bodies. Inmates used a hole in the floor as a toilet. The cell was filthy, covered with old feces and urine. Because hands were chained to waists, inmates were usually forced to urinate or defecate on themselves. Inmates in the pink room could not feed themselves with their hands due to the restraints. There was no running water in the pink room. Now, this is an example, the pink room, of solitary confinement to which people can be placed for up to 16 days in the hole, as it's called. And situations like this, you have a revolving time of being placed in the hole. Because once you're out, it's just on say-so, you can be put back in. But then there are people who are confined for year after year, not only to the disciplinary units, but in these super max prisons, these special prisons where intentionally they have virtual isolation, no windows, no contact with other prisoners. And let's look at some of these examples. Ralph, do you want to give some of...
In January 1995, and this is an account by International Criminal Law Committee in the Criminal Justice Section of the American Bar Association of Mark Sherman and contributed to by Laura Magnani and Bonnie Kernest. In January 1995, a federal court in California found that conditions at the security housing unit at Pelican Bay, a state prison operated by the California Department of Corrections, violate the constitutional rights of prisoners in that facility. The court described a pattern of brutality and neglect at Pelican Bay State Prison, a high-security complex which had opened in 1989. Individual cases of abuse were cited in plenitude, including the specific example of Von Dortich, a mentally disturbed prisoner who suffered third-degree burns over a third of his body after guards forced him with his arms handcuffed behind his back into a bath of scalding water. Arturo Castillo, who refused to hand over his food tray, had a gas gun fired into his cell and was knocked unconscious and beaten so severely that his scalp became detached. The judge found that the guards were never disciplined for excessive force and that their accounts of incidents were routinely accepted at face value. Amnesty International documented highly abusive and inhuman conditions at other supermax and control unit facilities. The H unit at Oklahoma State Penitentiary McAllister was opened in 1991 to house prisoners in disciplinary segregation. The inmates were housed in small, windowless cells for all but 5 hours a week. They were isolated from inmates. They were routinely bussed in upon by guards and beaten to a pulp. Amnesty concluded that these conditions amount to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. The torture devices that are routinized include stun belts, which were described by Julia Lutsky in The Guardian on July 28, 1999. And these, again, were reports amplified by Amnesty International on the, quote, widespread use by prison authorities of restraints in the form of stun belts that underlined the rising tide of repression sweeping the country. The first report issued in June 1996, cruelty and control, the stun belt, and other electroshock equipment in the law. The report details the use of a remote electronically activated control technology called REACT, made by Stun Tech of Cleveland, Ohio, and the remote activated custody control belt made by Nova Products of Cookeville, Tennessee. These stun belts are used throughout U.S. prisons since 1993. They are now part of the federal prison system and the U.S. Marshals Service. Amnesty International lists 112 jurisdictions in 30 states and correctional facilities in 20 states where the belts are routinely applied. In states where the stun belt is not allowed, stun guns, stun shields, and taser dart guns are in use, effectively replicating the conditions of the belt. These belts, as Maya had indicated, are attached to people as instruments of restraint. Amnesty International reports that the belt, quote, inflicts a 50,000-volt shock that enters the prisoner's left kidney region and travels along nerve pathways. Each pulse gives rise to rapid shock extending throughout the body, causing severe pain, instant incapacitation, and fibrillation of the heart, often leading to heart failure and death. Indeed, these are belts that are inflicted upon prisoners, as we've indicated, when they appear in courtrooms and they are operated at remote control. If anybody, including a marshal, let alone a judge, determines that by asking a question or by shaking his head or by indicating non-acceptance of a judicial comment, the prisoner can be immediately targeted and subjected to the shock of the stun belt. Deaths are routine, as Amnesty International reports. Individuals who are alive and active collapsed upon tasering and the use of these belts and did not survive. These are devices capable of, quote, depolarizing skeletal muscle, depolarizing heart muscle, and inducing fibrillation. In addition, StunTech has admitted, the producer, that, quote, stun belts have been accidentally activated by law enforcement officers 9 times as many times as they were deliberately activated. Every prisoner is asked by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons to sign a form. I repeat this. Every prisoner is made by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons to sign a form entitled Inmate Notification of Custody Control Belt Use. That means the prisoner accepts, by signing this form, the right of the prison authorities to not only impose these belts, but to activate them and shock them at will. And the consequences for prisoners who refuse to sign are immediate consignment to isolation and the arbitrary imposition of the belt. In April 1998, Ronald Hawkins faced sentencing after having been convicted for having stolen $265 worth of painkillers necessary to ease pain caused by AIDS. He was subjected to the Sun Belt, and he acted as his own lawyer. And when he asked a question of the judge that the judge considered to be non-acceptable, he was immediately subjected to the Sun Belt, which was activated. The Stun Belt, I'm sorry. The stun belt, which was activated. Quote, it is like a total paralyzing of my spine. Enormous pain in the back. I was paralyzed for a period of time, lying motionless on the floor. He filed a federal lawsuit stating that making a person wear a stun belt, and not just the activation of it, but the wearing of it alone, violates the U.S. Constitution. He noted that the stun belt, even when not activated, has the potential of compromising the defense. It has a chilling effect because an individual wearing a stun belt will not engage in any adequate defense of his rights because of the fear of being subjected at random to the pain of 50,000 volt jolts of electricity. What is the meaning of due process? What is this charade of individual rights when prisoners, overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly black, overwhelmingly Latino, are subjected to this venomous and vicious class war? It is as if Adolf Eichmann were the Attorney General of the United States, or Mengele were the head of the Justice Department. This is a routinized, sadistic form of torture and torment which has been institutionalized, legalized, and applauded by what passes for the judicial system in the United States.
Let's return again to the Supermax. Ralph has just gone in great detail about one form of torture, the use of stun belts and stun guns. But let's look at the psychological damage that is done intentionally to prisoners in Supermax prisoners, where they are subjected to prolonged isolation, The prisoners at the federal prison in Florence, Colorado, which replaced Marion as the federal supermax, describe being woken up every hour throughout the night by a flashlight shining in their face. They become so that they have a progressive inability to tolerate even ordinary stimulation, and they begin cutting themselves just so they can feel something. Returning again to the reports of Stuart Grassian, the Harvard University Medical School professor, a renowned psychiatrist. Quote, "The courts have recognized that solitary confinement itself can cause a very specific kind of psychiatric syndrome, which in its worst stages can lead to agitated, hallucinatory, confusional, psychotic state involving random violence, self-mutilation, suicidal behavior, agitated, fearful, and confusional kinds of symptoms." Grassian says, "I was pretty cynical when I was first brought into the study of control units. I didn't think I was going to find anything, but I did find something, and it was shocking to see what I found. That these inmates were so ill that they tended to be ill in very similar kinds of ways, that they were so frightened of what was happening to them that they weren't exaggerating their illness. They were tending to minimize it, to deny it. They were scared of it." An important article appeared in the New York Times, November 8, 1998, and is available in the New York Times archive. "Is Solitary Confinement Driving Charlie Chase Crazy?" by Bruce Porter. And he describes in great detail the story of this one particular individual who had been sent to a solitary unit in November of 1993 and had been in the DDU of the solitary unit for many years afterwards. In fact, until this period, he would be in it. And it said that with Charlie, his disciplinary reports show that he trashed his cell, threw feces and urine at guards, slashed a guard's wrists with a smuggled razor, and tried to break out. Why did this behavior happen? Was it intentional on Charlie's part? In fact, what the report of the New York Times shows clearly is that Charlie was driven to these actions by his 15 years of solitary confinement. They found that Charlie inflicted damage on himself. He banged his fists and butted his head against the cinder block walls, slit his wrists with a razor, carved a star inside a circle into his left breast. He used his own body as a surrogate target for someone else. Driven into a rage one day by a remark made by a guard, he reacted by punching the walls and doors and finally taking up a nail clipper that he had stashed in his mattress, sinking its tiny jaws into his left arm and severing a blood vessel. "It's this little one right here. See that?" he says matter-of-factly. "I stuck it in as far as it would go, and I cut it in two. You can tell when you get a vein. It sounds like it does when you're clipping a fingernail, just a little snip. Each beat of my heart, you could see the blood shooting out. I just sat there, let it go, until they came by and saw me and took it off," said Charlie. "Had the offending guard been within reach?" Charlie stated, "If I could have gotten my hands on that guard, but I couldn't, I would have stuck the clippers right into his eyes. And that's because the guard was driving Charlie crazy." After a period, Charlie was sent to Bridgewater State Mental Hospital. He was hearing voices and seeing visions of sparkling dust floating in his cell. And this is what was noted by the prison psychologist. After a period of time in the less harsh environment of the hospital, where he was let out of his room to mingle with other patients, his mood stabilized. But once his mood stabilized, he was sent back to the prison The cycle resumed, and Charlie's file grew fatter. My best sense, one prison psychologist wrote several months after Charlie arrived in the DDU, is the patient has experienced a psychotic decompensation as a result of the stress related to his restrictive milieu. Decompensation, in layman's terms, means complete loss of control. As the episodes become more frequent, the likelihood increases that Charlie's mental state will fall under the control of what psychiatrists call a kindling effect. The episodes will become more progressive, Stuart Grassian writes, and only get worse. So if you keep a person like Charlie in the DDU and you keep him sick for as long as he's in there, you're probably causing biochemical changes that are going to be permanent, causing this individual to become permanently impaired. Psychological damage that leads to violence, violence against others, and self-inflicted violence. As Grassian states, quote, imagine yourself in a situation of absolute total monotony, absolutely nothing coming in from the outside. What happens is you first start to become jumpy, overly sensitive to external stimulation. You start thinking about something and you can't stop, and it starts to drive you crazy. The drip of a faucet becomes intense and agonizing. Or someone flushes a toilet and you start feeling rage towards this person and you want to kill him. Your impulse control starts to go. People just fly off the handle, going into these agitated, confusional states. Paranoia becomes severe. Everything starts to have meaning, and bad meanings, frightening meanings. This impotent rage builds up over a period of time, so you're totally wired and the rage becomes pervasive. You can't get this idea of torture out of your mind. Killing, torturing the guards, high voltage obsession for revenge that is just ready to explode. So when something happens, there's this lightning bolt of discharge with nothing in its path, nothing in the world to resist it, nothing else in the sphere of your attention. Now, Grassian is describing what happens to you, to me, to any person. Any person subjected to being buried alive, subjected to sensory deprivation, subjected to total isolation without human contact. This is normal behavior. This is what happens. This is what happens to people when they are buried alive in these supermax prisons.
I can tell you from my little personal experience in a 3x4x5 box at 13,000 feet in the Andes in Bolivia. The hatred and the desire to have revenge against the guards is only the late aftermath. You're lucky if you have it. You're lucky if you reach it. Your first feelings in that kind of condition are panic and despair. Hours merge into days, days into weeks. You don't see anybody. You don't hear anything. You have no distraction. The total dissociation that sets in is indescribable. And the desperation and the feeling of abandonment and of hopelessness overwhelm. Hatred is a luxury. Desire for revenge is a sign of health. It is only those who are strong enough that are even able to marshal emotions directed outside of their sense of total hysteria and despair. There are so many aspects of the torment of the prisoners that are routinely subjected to these conditions across the United States. Let me take one moment to address the question of women. In our part two, we will go into the treatment of women and children in greater detail. Women in prison are nominally supposed to be in institutions set aside under the authority of a responsible woman officer, with no male member of the staff able to enter that part of the institution. This is a total fiction. I read to you from the Institutional Personnel Mini Rule Part 1. But what is the reality? As the American Friends Service Committee voluminous documentation establishes, a woman writing from Arizona, Texas, women writing from Arizona, Texas, Missouri, and New York, quote, the only thing you get in isolation is a peanut butter sandwich in the morning, a cheese sandwich in the afternoon. The guard sprayed me with pepper spray because I wouldn't take my clothes off in front of file male guards. They carried me into the cells, laid me down on a steel bed, and took my clothes off. They left me in the cell with that pepper spray in my face. When I refused to move, they came into the cell and dragged me out and threw me on my back. I was beaten on my face and heads. One of the guards stuck his fingers in my eyes. I was rolled on my stomach, cuffed on my wrists, leg irons on my ankles, made to walk 1,000 feet with the leg irons. They put me in devices called a restraining chair. They put you in this chair with your hands cuffed behind your back and tucked under your buckets. They stripped me naked. They kept me there over 9 hours till I fouled myself on my hands. I am tired of being gynecologically examined. This was not part of my sentence to perform forced oral sex with officers. Here is Yvette W. from the Camden County Correctional Facility. From the time you change your clothes downstairs and put on one of their uniforms, you are, as a human being, dying in front of their eyes. We are forced to sleep on the floor in the middle of winter with bad backs and aching bodies. We are subjected to constant sexual abuse. We are subjected to rape. We are subjected to forced oral sex. It is a daily event. These are not random stories. This is the continuity of the treatment of women in prison institutions across the United States. Children, the story is, if anything, even more horrific. This is a torment which has a class content. Because as we will discuss in our second part of this program, the economics, the social content of this, is the continuation of the conditions of slavery, because the economic meaning of this rendering of an underclass of over 2 million people is to provide a pumping of the economy for prison institutions and towns which depend upon it, and a rendering of the population as an underclass as a way of obtaining the profits of forced labor and the driving down of the wages of working people outside the prison system itself. Class war, the degradation of the few, or the many, excuse me, the underclass targeted, the near-slave conditions that are the prison institutions of the United States, the real meaning of capitalist America, torture, the constant of American treatment of its abandoned and its imprisoned.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Buried Alive, Torture in America. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or call us in California at 707-552-9995. Contact us by email at takingaim@wbai.org. Again, that's wbai.org. And you can visit our website, Taking Aim, www.takingaim.info, that's .info, where you'll find much information, an archive of our past programs. We'll be with you next week.